Hello, and thank you for listening to episode 7 of 60 Minutes With. I'm Dave, and I'm back with the first interview show of 2015, and what a great show it is, if I may say so myself. Most people know me as a big Kiss fan, so there is no surprise at how excited I've been to get the opportunity to chat with this guy that you're about to listen to. What I'd like to say as well, because this isn't a Kiss-specific podcast, although you wouldn't think so some of the times that I go on about the band, I thought I'd take this opportunity to find out more about the man himself. So obviously we're going to chat about Kiss, the book that he's got coming out, but let's learn a little bit about the guy, what happened before he was with Kiss and what happened afterwards, and get up to date with what he's doing now. So please sit back, get comfortable, and get ready to spend 60 minutes or so with me and J.R. Smalling. Right, JR, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I've been looking forward to this one so much.
The pleasure is all mine, as I have been looking forward to it as well.
Oh, lovely. I should also thank you as well, because my book, Out on the Streets, my autographed copy of it, plopped through the letterbox just a few days ago, so thank you so much as well. I'm maybe a third of the way through at the moment and loving it.
Oh, great. That's good to hear, man. Yeah. The reviews have been stellar, and we're very pleased by all of that. You know, we wrote this for the fans who have been asking us for decades, you know, all the varied questions and all, and we figured we'd get all of that stuff out of the way in one fell swoop, and that's where we are.
Oh, I'm so glad you did, because these are stories that, I mean, there's a lot of Kiss books out there, but this one's got the totally different angle from it, coming from you guys, people that were there right from the beginning and, you know, in the thick of it, because it's so good to hear stories like that.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad that we're able to shed some light on some of the things that people want to know about those early days, for sure, because we were right in the thick of it, so to speak.
Before we get to that, let's have a little chat about you, your early days. Can you tell the listeners where you grew up and a little bit about, you know, what were you listening to when you were growing up too?
Well, excuse me, being an old guy, I was fortunate in that I was introduced to live music by some of the best artists of the time in the mid and late 50s by my sister and my older cousins. Some may be familiar with Alan Freed, who was a pioneer, early pioneer here in the States of rock, or I guess at the time it was called rock and roll music and soul music. He was a DJ and a concert promoter, and he had the Alan Freed Review. There was also something called the Motown Review. And what those were basically was Motown Review was they would put all of the acts that were on the Motown label, Temptations, Four Tops, Supremes, Little Anthony and the Imperial, I mean, just every group of that type that was on the charts would put on a show on the same day, same venue, for one low price. And I was fortunate enough to attend some of those gigs, like I say, back in the late 50s. And once I attended my first live show and saw all of the hysteria that was going on and all the very cool things that were happening in and around those events, man, I was pretty much hooked. Fast forwarding a few years to my latter years in high school, I got turned on to rock music by first hearing Cream and Jimi Hendrix, and I started playing drums immediately upon hearing that stuff, and played with a bunch of bands in Brooklyn, and got to perform. And once I actually sat behind a drum kit on stage and got paid for it, and got to see the reaction of the fans' faces, then, well, I was hooked even more, you know. So it was, I was immersed in music from a very early age, fortunately so.
What got you hooked on drums and not guitar? Because usually people, like, gravitate towards the guitar, don't they?
Yeah, I believe so. But, you know, like I say, the very first hard rock album, if you would, a classic rock album that I heard was was Fresh Cream. And I was very much, maybe it's because of the home that I first heard it in. The guy was a drummer, and he had a set of drums and not a guitar. So, we fooled around, we played along with the tracks, at that time. And then from there, we started jamming with some guitar players and bass players and keyboard players. And I just stuck with what I knew. I'm a very rhythmical guy, not so high on the melody, so to speak. And the drums just fell in naturally. And of course, Ginger Baker's style, not being as flamboyant and flashy as a Mitch Mitchell, who was a very fast, speedy type drummer. Ginger Baker's style was much easier to emulate and imitate, as a fledgling drummer. So that was where I started. And like I say, when I then heard Jimi Hendrix and Mitch Mitchell and subsequent drummers from there, I was able to tweak my style a bit and really improve my chops, so to speak. But Ginger Baker for me was the first guy, and I loved it from the minute I heard it. Speaking of drummers, one of the drummers that went on to achieve some fame and is now a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, as a matter of fact, was a rival drummer of mine in Brooklyn. His band played with my band. Actually, they rehearsed in my parents' home. We all rehearsed together. I don't know if you're familiar with a group from the 70s called Dust, DUST. Dust. Well, the drummer for that band was a gentleman, a great drummer by the name of Mark Bell. And he played with Dust. They recorded two albums together, and they were one of the first U.S. power trios. And when Dust broke up, Mark went on to play for a bunch of other groups, Richard Hell and the Voidoids being one of them. But he found his niche when he met Joey Ramone, and he changed his name, and he's now the Marky Ramone from the Ramones that everybody knows. So a lot of history came out of my parents' house, actually. The bass player for Dust was a gentleman named Kenny Aronson, great bass player. And Kenny went on to play with a lot of bands. He played with the New York Dolls in their second incarnation. He played with Foghat for a while. He played with Billy Idol. He played with Billy Squier, Bob Dylan, just a bunch of people. And I think that's a testament to his musical abilities. And I guess maybe one of the most important people in that band, certainly for me and my becoming involved with Kiss in the first place, was the guitar player, a gentleman by the name of Richie Wise. Richie and his partner, who was the manager of Dust, Kenny Kerner, they produced the Kiss album, the first Kiss album, and they produced Hotter Than Hell. So with that, after I left my band, the band that I was playing with, after high school, we moved upstate New York, and we took a home up there, and we proceeded to get our chops together to present ourselves to a record company. And unfortunately, the home that we were renting burned down in a fire. It was a very tragic scene. But in an effort to earn enough money to buy a new set of drums while staying in the business, I started working for our rival group, Dust, and I actually became Mark Ramone's first drum roadie. So, after that, and while Mark, as I say, went on to play with Richard Hell and the Voidoids and a bunch of other bands, I went on to work with groups like the Dutch group Focus. I worked with an English gentleman by the name of Dave Mason, formerly of Traffic. And I worked also with an English group called Tranquility, a great, great band, three guitars, bass, drums, and keyboards. And they were just phenomenal. We did gigs on their tours. We did gigs with David Bowie. We did gigs with Yes. We did gigs with Jake Isles' band. I mean, it was really, really a great, great time. And in 1973, late 1973, after coming off the road on a tour with a Focus, I got a call from Richie Wise, and he told me, he said, "Listen, I've just recorded an album, just produced an album with this new band. They're going to be great, very visual band, a lot of special effects, and they need a guy with your experience to help them get the show on the road each and every night." I said, "Great." You know, I wasn't really thrilled. I just come off with Jake Isles, who was near the top of the charts at that point in time. And I said, "Yeah, the group." He said, "The group is Kiss, called Kiss, and they're doing a showcase at the Fillmore East on January 8th, I believe it was. You know, you should come down and check them out. And if you like them, they like you. You know, you can jump on board." So I kind of reluctantly almost dragged myself down there. And like most first-time Kiss fans, I was knocked out. I mean, the show was just phenomenal, like nothing I'd ever seen. You know, bombs, of course, and fog, and the drums elevating in the air, this guy spitting blood, this guy spewing flames and all. And I was like, I don't know what this is, but yeah, I can do this. You know, it was very exciting to me to think that I could be a part of helping them to get their show on the road. So I met with their manager, Bill O'Korn, briefly after the show, and had a follow-up interview and meeting the next week. And the rest, as they say, is history.
And you mentioned the bombs there when you saw them. Of course, back then, like smoke bombs and pyro, the health and safety issues were not quite as strict as they are nowadays, were are they?
No, not at all. Not at all. And of course, you know, being as it was their very early incarnation, the flash pods, as they were nothing of the size and impact that they came to be under the squire, if you will, of the original Kiss crew. Myself, Peter Orokinto, who's affectionately known to most as Moose. Mick Campisi, who was Peter Criss's drum roadie, and Rick Monroe, who was our lighting director, and the four of us, you know, were the crew in the early days. And of course, the crew grew from there. But I'm very proud to say that you know, the show that you see today, the Kiss show that you see today, is for all intents and purposes the exact same show as we put on, you know, 40 years ago. Of course, it's bigger and it's better now. They've got infinitely more money and a much larger stage set and much more guys on the crew. But, you know, the drums still elevate, the Gene still spits fire, he still drools blood. The flash pods are nothing like they used to be because of some of those safety issues. You know, there were some unfortunate tragedies that happened revolving around open pyrotechnics on the stage, not with Kiss. I'm happy to say that no one ever got injured during our tenure with the original band. And like I say, we developed the show from the kind of rudimentary designs that they could afford and had at the time, to the kind of bombastic, loud, you know, building shaking explosions that we delivered, and the flames, the columns of flames, you know, shooting up from the stage, as it were. So we're very, very proud of what we did during our time with the band.
And of course, one thing they've still got as well is the iconic intro. You know, you wanted the best, you got the best.
Absolutely.
And of course, you're a major part of that coming to be. Could you tell the listeners of the story of how that intro sort of became to be?
It's an interesting story. It's a very interesting story. We actually did a lot of shows with Blue Oyster Cult. Actually, let me back up. Before I came along, the group had done some shows on their own and some small clubs. And even when I did come on board, the intro was performed by their road manager and really their guru, and a gentleman who was pretty much acknowledged as being the fifth member of KISS. His name was Sean Delaney. And Sean was the guy that behind the scenes helped them to develop their makeup into what it became. He dressed them all in black with the leathers and the platforms. He gave them their iconic choreography that they still use on stage today in songs like Deuce and other songs. He was really the guy that helped them to pull together some individual ideas that they had floating around their heads, and he helped them polish it to make those ideas become what everyone is known to, to love. But his intro was very simply something that said, "Okay, whatever city it is, if you're ready to rock, then put your two lips together and kiss." And it was nice, but it was nowhere near as gnarly as the bombast and what was about to be unleashed on the unsuspecting audience, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And we had done a bunch of gigs early on with Blue Oyster Cult, who were very popular at the time. They had a couple of hit songs, and the funny thing is, even though small in stature, I mean, those guys were probably, the tallest guy in the band was maybe 5'8". But and some of us, and certainly Gene and Ace in their platforms, they were almost a foot taller than these guys standing side by side. But their intro was, "All right, you dogs, on your feet or on your knees, Blue Oyster Cult, you know?" And it was a monstrous intro. It really it kicked the audience in the ass and really set the stage for their show. And after witnessing the difference in their intro and our intro for a while, I started to think that certainly we could do better, and I started playing around with some ideas, and it really took me a few months to come up with the intro that everyone knows. But later on in 74, the second album came out, Hotter Than Hell, and of course everything was, on that theme, hotter than hell, heat, flash pods, bombs, explosions, blowing flames. And I started to play around with that particular theme. Right around that same time, there was a television commercial for Toyota, and the jingle that accompanied that commercial was a catchy phrase. It went, "You asked for it, you got it, Toyota." So I was sitting in a hotel one night after the show, and the commercial came on, and it was kind of catchy. I said, "Wow, you asked for it, you got it, hot, heat, hotter than,
Yeah.
And I played around with it and, tried a couple of different variations, and finally got down to what is heard on the first Alive album, of which my voice is the first voice that's heard, and it was, "You wanted the best and you got it, the hottest band in the land, Kiss." And they've used either that intro or a form of that intro, effectively only changing a couple of words, for the last 40 years. I think now it's a, "You wanted the best and you got the best, the hottest band in the world, Kiss." But when I made that intro, they hadn't yet conquered the world, and they hadn't left the North America. So in my mind, hottest band in the land, it kind of rhymed a little bit. It made sense, and that's why I said it the way that I said it. By the time Alive 2 came out, they had toured Europe and they had toured Japan, and they really were the hottest band in the land, and they elected to change it enough to reflect that. But certainly, I'm proud that the essence of the intro that they've used for the past 40 years was my creation. And it pleases me. You know, you'll never believe how many people come up to me, you know, say, JR, oh man, thank you so much. That intro, that really kicked it off. You know, when I heard that on a live, followed by the music, I've been a KISS fan ever since. And you know, it's a real great thing to be a part of so many people's lives. So, you know, to the fans who they share that reaction, I do thank them very much.
Oh, that's fantastic. You know, because I've been lucky enough to see KISS live, what, 26 times now, and every time that intro's said, goosebumps appear every single time. And it must be incredible for you know, to look back on this, that you're sort of enshrined within this huge part of musical history and will forever be associated with it like that, because that intro alone is just, like you say, it's such a kick-ass start to a concert. It's incredible.
Absolutely. And you know, it was a great thing because the first night that I actually settled on the intro as it came to be known, I did the intro always from stage right wings, you know, from Gene's side of the stage, out of the view of the audience. And of course, the band walks on stage in almost pitch darkness, and they plug in and they make sure they're in tune, and then they all kind of look over to the announcer, who was me, and say, give that nod, like, okay, we're ready, you know. And that first night, I ripped it up, and I got this look. Paul gave me this look, like, you know, the band got almost excited, as excited as the audience did when they heard it for the first time, you know. And this kind of smile went on his face, and they lit into Deuce, and the lights went up, and then seeing the audience's reaction to the intro and the bombs and these four maniacs in makeup on stage running around and other creating this kind of chaos. It was really very gratifying each and every night.
Oh
Great,
yeah.
great thing. Great thing, man. Yeah.
What was it like back then in New York in the early 70s? I know, because I mean, speaking as somebody from the UK, America's like a different world anyway. But when you go back into a different era like the early 70s as well, can you give the listeners some sort of flavor of what New York was like back then?
Well, yeah, New York, in the early 70s, it was really a very, very strange scene. It was a very gritty type surroundings. You know, the city was nowhere near as I guess genteel, if I could use that word. It was really it was a gritty kind of gray place. Crime was pretty rampant. Drugs were pretty rampant. But also the glam rock scene was pretty rampant, you know. Groups like the New York Dolls, for example, one of the first bands to go all out with makeup and glitter and platform shoes and just outrageous looking bands, you know. Blondie was forming at the time. The Talking Heads were just coming out. The music scene was very much live at the time, but it was the bands were nowhere near the success. They didn't have the success of bands that preceded them. You know, bands like the Young Rascals, for example, was a totally different kind of group. So it was a different time, but it was the youth and the early stages of what would come to be known as glam and glam rock and punk rock, you know, that spawned groups like the Ramones that I mentioned. You know, Steely Dan, while they weren't glam or punk, great band that started in New York at the same time, around the same time. And it was just a very, very vibrant scene. A lot of clubs. You know, I mentioned before Hendrix and Cream and the like. You know, the Fillmore East was very much happening place. Not so much in the late 70s. They had closed by that time, but late 60s, the Fillmore East had every band that you wanted to see. You know, at a very cheap rate, $3.50.
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, I was fortunate in that one of my good friends and another musician was a stagehand at the Fillmore East, and as such, I was able to sneak in the back door with him, and I got to see everybody from Hendrix to Cream to Deep Purple to Zeppelin to, I mean, you name it, literally you name it. If I wanted to see them, and I did want to see most of the bands, I did get to see them. I remember seeing Jimi Hendrix in a club, a small club, probably 150 seat club called a Cafe Wa down in the village. And it was so much of a club that there were the little, round club type tables that we all know in all of these little clubs. And I was actually sitting right literally underneath Jimi Hendrix. I could have reached out and touched him if I wanted to. And he's playing and he's wailing and his sweat is flying all over the place, But it was really, it was really a great, great time from the late 60s right up to and after, when Kiss formed in 73 and 74 and moving forward from there. Great, great, great times.
What was your favorite gig from back then?
Meaning what, that the favorite gig that I witnessed or the favorite gig
The
that
favorite one that you went to, as somebody in the audience.
Well, I mean, like I say, there's, you can't beat being close enough to Hendrix to feel the heat coming off of his body. I must admit that seeing Zeppelin on their first U.S. tour was phenomenal. Being a drummer, John Bonham was an immediate. I idolized him immediately. I was fortunate enough to see Jeff Beck group with Rod Stewart on lead vocals and Ronnie Wood when he was still playing bass. They as well were phenomenal. I think you can feel the theme there. My particular clique, if you would, were very much into the English rock sound. Kinks and the like. As I mentioned, Deep Purple and even some latter groups, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, Yes. You name it, you name it. Anything that was musically challenging to play was where the group of friends that I came from, that's what we gravitated towards. And we were not let down. We knew that if we were going to go see an English band, more than likely we were going to get blown away. I mean, Jethro Tull, for example, groups like that were just phenomenal. There's certainly is nowhere near the great number of tremendous bands that they have out that we had then available to be seen on a weekly basis, for the prices that we got to see them for. So it was really wonderful. It was a really wonderful time.
Oh yeah, they were definitely golden days, weren't they? For like you
Absolutely.
say, for the amount of bands and the quality of the bands, and add to that, the price of the tickets as well. That's just a mixture made in heaven, right there.
For sure, for sure. Yeah.
So you see Kiss, and you see them for the first time, and you're blown away by them. What process happened then from you seeing them for you working with them?
Well, the I had been introduced to them, like I said, by their producers, Kenny Kerner and Richie Wise. So, being a fledgling band, having never performed together anywhere as a band, they pretty much were new to the business. And like I said, I'd been out on the road with major acts for a couple of years before them. So when my name was mentioned and who I had worked with and the experience that I had was put on the table, they were more than anxious to have me on board. And it was a relatively easy process. I met with Bill O'Coin, and we discussed it all. I had been road managing bands. There was a rehearsal studio in New York at the time called Baggies. And Baggies was the place where not only American groups, but in particular groups coming over from Europe to do their American tours, they would put it all together in Baggies as the first place in the States that they would rehearse and get together to tour. And as such, I became one of the go-to guys that worked out of Baggies because a lot of the road managers at the time, you got to realize this was the beginning of that particular rock invasion. Of course, the Beatles had their British invasion, 10 years earlier. But it was a totally different animal. The Beatles were at the time, very squeaky clean kind of thing, and it was totally different. But with the hard rock bands coming over, the names that I mentioned, a lot of the groups themselves and a lot of the tour managers had never toured the States before, and they hired me, amongst a couple of other individuals that worked out of Baggage, but they hired me, us, to be their shepherd, so to speak, and to take them through these gigs in the States for the first time, get their feet wet, and show them how things worked over here. And believe me, it was totally different than how things were going in Europe. Seriously, with union crews, and all of the restrictions that went around that. Plus, just I mean, the things as simply as navigating around the country, and just knowing the country like the back of my hand, as the expression goes. There were no satellite navigation systems and all of that good stuff. So, we became very important to those groups, and giving them a certain amount of comfort, knowing that they weren't on their own in this foreign country. So, Kiss realized the experience that I had at that level, and aspiring to get to those levels themselves, it was only natural that they would, seek out someone with my experience to help them do that. And that's where we were.
It's a good job you did know the country like the back of your hand, because I know from reading the book, and I was amazed I didn't know about this with some of the concerts that were cancelled, and you would drive from one place
Oh,
hundreds and
yeah.
hundreds of miles only to find it was cancelled, to travel,
Absolutely.
like 700 odd miles back the other way. That's incredible.
Yeah, it was very frustrating. It was very, very frustrating, and we called it the dartboard tour, because it seemed as if the booking agents just put a map of the U.S. up on the wall and just threw darts at it and decided that that's where we were going to play. But you have to remember that no band climbed the ladders of success ever as quickly as Kiss did without a hit record. In those days, you had to have a hit record if you wanted to be a headline act or even a special guest act, and even to get on a tour as an opening act. Usually, you had to have a record that a record station would play to give you any kind of value as an opening act to the headliner or to the promoter, or give them a reason why to put you on the show. Kiss didn't have that really until very later on, with Detroit Rock City to some extent, and of course after that came Beth and Rock and Roll All Night, Party Every Day, that kind of stuff. But what made Kiss the success that they became so quickly was their reputation of delivering a kick-ass show, and that's really, the word of mouth around that, you couldn't beat it. It was the best publicity possible, and people just, did you see this band? Oh, I saw this band, last week. That was crazy. The drums went up in the air, and this guy's blowing. Oh, come on, you're kidding me? Nah, man, come on. So it wasn't unusual for us during those first couple of years to play a city like Detroit, for example. Detroit kind of embraced Kiss, as their own band. Even though the band was from New York, Detroit became our second home, because we played Detroit in the first year. Maybe, God, I've never counted it, but I would say we played Detroit at least 4 or 5 times in separate, dates, and that is unheard of, So we went in the first time, and we were the opening act for whomever. I think it might have been Blue Oyster Cult, and it went really well. And then we came back, and we were special guests for somebody else. And before too long, we were headlining in Michigan Palace, which was, The it was kind of like the Fillmore East type theater of Detroit, and we headlined that at 2,500 seat capacity, 3,000 seat capacity. And before long, we were special guesting for major acts in Cobo Hall. That was a 10 or 12,000 seat venue. And shortly after that, which is where the Detroit or a lot of the songs for the Alive album were recorded, we headlined at Cobo Hall. So it was like climbing a ladder or climbing up a set of stairs. Every time we would return to a city, we returned in a bigger and better venue, you know what I mean? So it was always exciting to us, and it was always exciting to the fans to be able to see the band as they grew from the act that they first saw to the headliners that they became so quickly.
That's it, isn't it, though? With you being constantly on the road like that, as well as it being, a lot of pressure on the crew, it's like damned hard work for you, what, constantly too.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, we did over 125 shows. I'm not sure the exact number, but we did over 125 shows the first year alone. You know what I mean? So that's a show every 3 days, and then when you add in the fact that sometimes we had to drive almost 2 days to get to a show, I mean, we were, and I say we because the crew was really as almost as much a part of the show as the band was. If you've ever seen a Kiss show, any of your listeners have ever seen the Kiss show, they'll know that, the flash pods go off and sync perfectly in whatever songs each and every night. The fog pours on the stage on cue each and every night. Everything that happens, we liken ourselves to be like a traveling Broadway show. Put to rock music, in that we wore so many hats. We were special effects engineers. We were prop masters. Of course, we were roadies. We were truck drivers. We administered to the costumes. We were carpenters. We were mechanics fixing the drum machine as it broke down each and every night, seemingly. So yeah, it was an amazing time, and we dedicated ourselves to that. As much for the group and the fans, wanting to deliver the show that they expected, but out of pride for ourselves, knowing that something at this level had never been done before, and accepting the task to do it each and every night. And fortunately for the band, and fortunately for the fans and us, we succeeded at that. So it was a very gratifying time.
Oh, I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was. And what did you do on the few occasions that you got some time off? What did you guys do to relax?
We bought new gear. We built new stages. We fixed the gear. We accompanied the band in the studio because they were recording. The truth of the matter is that if we weren't on the road getting to a gig, or if we weren't at a gig, we were in the studio. So there was really no downtime per se, especially in that first year, year and a half. There were no 2 week vacations or anything like that. We had to build on the momentum that had been developed up to that point in time, which is why, you'll see so many of those types of crisscrossing the continent kind of gigs. The band opened up for anybody that would have them, and with that, the band opened up with everybody from like I say, Dr. John to Billy Preston, for example. I mean, how different is that? Blue Oyster Cult, Black Oak, Arkansas, which was a southern kind of rock band. So it was really very, very crazy. Argent, an English band, Savoy Brown, another English band. Any group that would have us, we played with, because we knew that once the audience saw the show, they became Kiss fans, and that was the truth. That was the truth.
And of course, this led, didn't it, to some of the headline acts not being too enamored with Kiss because they blew them off the stage.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we talk about that in the book. And one of the classiest guys that we ever worked with, probably the classiest guy that we worked with, was Ozzy. We opened up for Black Sabbath a couple of shows, and I believe it was the second night of what was to have been a tour. Kiss did their thing, and as an opening act, we only had maybe 30, 35 minutes. But as would happen, first time viewers of Kiss, when the band left the stage, the audience was whipped up into such a frenzy that they would spend, 15, 20 minutes just, chanting, "Kiss, kiss, kiss, kiss," trying to get them back out for an encore or whatever. And of course, the headline acts didn't like that because, in this particular instance with Black Sabbath, the audience chanted "Kiss" repeatedly through the entire 20-minute, half-hour set change, and right through the first 10 or 15 minutes of the Black Sabbath set. So Black Sabbath weren't too thrilled with that, and we hung around, to watch the show because, let's face it, being younger than them, and we were fans of theirs, and it was really thrilling to be on the same bill with them. So we wanted to watch the show. And after Black Sabbath came on stage, Ozzy actually came back to the dressing room, and he shook each and every person's hand in that dressing room, from band to crew, and very sincerely said, "Hey, man, you guys were great tonight. Anytime the headline act can't hold their audience," he says, "the opening act must be phenomenal." And he says, "And you guys are phenomenal." And he thanked us, and he gave us that accolade. And then two shows later, we were off the tour. That's what happened. But for every band that didn't want us to open up, for them or be special guests or appear anywhere near them, there were the promoters who realized that Kiss was, in a lot of instances, selling more tickets than the headline act. And of course, they fought to have Kiss on the show, and the smart acts, which happened sometimes with Blue Oyster Cult and things like that, the smart acts, realizing that they couldn't follow Kiss, even though their name was higher on the bill and in bigger letters, the smart acts allowed themselves to perform before Kiss. So they didn't have to deal with any of that distraction during their show. And it's in part because of that that Kiss, like I say, ascended, so quickly and were able to headline their own shows as rapidly as they did without a hit record.
And you said a good phrase there when you said that people fought for Kiss to be on their shows. And of course, for the listeners that may not be aware, I mean, the crew, they fought for Kiss. You guys put your body on the line for Kiss sometimes. It come down to the line, didn't it?
Absolutely. It's when you're on the road, the traveling entourage, it's really, the entourage against the world. You're in a city, and in the case of a lot of bands, English bands in particular, when they're in the States, they're in a totally foreign land. For Kiss, when we were in the southern part of the United States, that may as well have been a foreign land. There are these guys, the audience running around in jeans and coveralls, and very much into a rural vibe, and in walks these guys, 6 feet tall and more, in platforms, wearing leathers and just outrageous makeup and things like that. And a lot of the locals didn't take too kindly to Kiss, until they saw the stage show, after which point they immediately became fans. But we had to literally fight our way in and out of some of the venues just because of the fact that people didn't like the way that they looked, and they were from a different part of the country, and it became a battle pretty much. And there's a very famous story of Kiss when they opened up for Argent back in those days. We were not friendly with Argent at all, and while it never came to blows, we did have to honestly, we did have to push some people around who tried to push us around, but we would not have it. And in short order, it became known on the touring circuit that you didn't screw with the Kiss guys because they were not, I mean, we were just not having it. You know, we were very nice guys, you know, big guys. I'm a big guy. I'm almost 6'3", and I was, you know, a Titan tone 2 1/4 back then. Moose had been a wrestler in school and whatnot. He was also 6'3". He was 275, very much in shape. And we had guys, our sound man, Jay Barth, Hot Sam, I think he was probably 6'5", you know, and we just had the attitude that come hell or high water, the show would go on and no one would stand in the way of that, you know. So while we weren't bullies, we didn't take being bullied either. And that word got around. And it's funny because some groups, I mentioned, Black Oak, Arkansas. They were one of those groups. They were out of Arkansas, which is in you know, the south central part of the United States, and it's very, very rural vibe. And you know, they were easygoing guys, I guess, but they were used to headlining their own shows and calling their own shots and getting their own way. Well, as soon as we came on the scene and we had all of this, you know, massive amount of equipment, and we needed certain amount of stage space to set up this levitating drum riser, and there need to be a certain amount of room behind the amps so that we could have our fog machines, you know, heating up hot water in the back. And it was a production the likes of which hadn't been seen at the time, and the headline acts were really reluctant to give up all of this amount of stage space to a group that they'd never seen before. And we very politely but firmly made those acts know that this is what we needed and this is what we were going to have, you know. And we got that. And after seeing the band a few times and, like I say, having the promoters realize, you know, what the ticket selling ability that Kiss had, and they didn't want to lose that. They stood behind us a lot, but Black Oak, Arkansas, they combated our bulk very quickly, and that the next time we work with them, they hired a guy that was bigger than both Moose and I, you know, and he was hired. I'm sure they told him, listen, you know, we're going to be working with these guys, and we don't want you to take any crap from them. And he was not the friendliest guy out there. You know, we were all very friendly guys, and we got along with a lot of bands famously. We were very tight with Rush, you know, they were great guys. We were very tight with Manfred Mann's Earth Band and English Band, you know, because they didn't push back on us, you know. And if they didn't push back on us, we had no reason. We weren't, like I say, we weren't bullies. But if you pushed us, you know, you got pushed back harder. And people really understood that. And I'm sure that Dave, when he was hired, his name was Little Dave. And he was bigger, like I say, than Moose and I. And he was not, he never cracked a smile. He was there to do a job. And, you know, nothing ever came to blows because even though they hired him to serve, you know, for a certain purpose, here again, there was only so much that they could do because by that time the promoters were on our side, and they couldn't lose, you know, the ticket, the ticket draw that Kiss got. And after a while, it went from being physical to, well, listen, Mr. Promoter, if we don't get what we want, we're not going to perform, you know. So you need to talk to the headline act and straighten this out before this gets ugly. And that's usually what happened, you know, and as the group rose in stature. So we never really had to bully anybody that didn't try to bully us first. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, that's great that you got the groups back like that, and it sounds like a good family atmosphere that you've got going back at that time. You must have got to know the group like on a personal basis then, each individual member.
Absolutely, absolutely. Like I say, you know, we were together all of the time, all of the time, and I mean, we didn't go anywhere without each other before. They started to make a little more money, and they could hire, you know, some security guys. You know, we were the crew was their security. You know, if they wanted to go to a club in the deep south or anywhere else that they weren't known, looking the way they did, they dare not walk into any of those you know, country type venues. You know, themselves, they weren't tough guys. You know, Peter had been a gang member, and he was a scrappy guy, but he was a little guy. He was the littlest guy in the group. You know, Gene, being the biggest, was nowhere near the type of a guy that would, you know, would fare well in any type of altercation, and neither was Peter or was Paul or Ace, for that matter. You know what I mean? So we all stuck very closely to each other. We were all very tight-knit. We all grew up in New York City, so we had an affinity for each other. You know, we were basically, you know, the same guys in different bodies. And like I say, when there's only nine of you and you're 1,000 miles away from home, and you stick out like a sore thumb, you know, there's strength in numbers, and we did become a family.
It must have made things a little bit difficult as well, you know, with the whole thing back then of keeping their identities secret. I mean, luckily, you know, it's not like it is now with the internet and, you know, everybody's got a smartphone with a camera on, but it still must have made life a bit harder than normal for you.
For sure, it was difficult, but here again, you know, with the size of the guys that we had around, myself and Moose and you know, some of the other guys, you know, it was very much easier to, quote unquote, convince a fan to you know, to give up the roll of film in that camera. You know, than it is now when you're dealing with professional paparazzi, whose sole jobs are, you know, they make thousands and thousands of dollars on candid photos that no one has. You know what I mean? So it was very easy back in those days to approach someone very politely and say, "Listen, you know, no pictures allowed, and can we have your film?" And usually they gave up the film willingly. If they did, we'd pay them for the film and give them their camera back. But if anybody got loud with us, it wasn't unusual to grab them by the neck, rip the camera off of their shoulders, and smash it into the ground, and the film would be exposed to the light. And there, now try to develop that. You know what I mean? So once that rumor got around, or that reality got around, we had no problems with that as well. And I'm very proud to say that here again, you know, no one ever threatened the band during our tenure with the band, and no one got any pictures of the band without makeup while we were around as well. Many tried, nobody succeeded,
That's
and
brilliant.
yeah, you know, we're very, very proud of that. You know,
Oh, yeah.
we serve those guys on so many levels. It was a very gratifying thing. And you know, to be honest, you know, the book is not all. I don't know. Have you finished reading the book yet?
No, I haven't yet. No, I'm still ploughing through it and loving it. You know, it's one of those books, and I'm not saying this just to blow smoke because you're on the show with me. It's one of those books that you want to read, you don't want to put it down, but you don't want to finish it because once you've finished it, it's finished, you know. And oh yeah, so yeah, I'm savoring it like a fine wine at the moment.
Well, I won't spoil it for you, but let's just say that the way that it ended for the crew is not the way that we would have written it had we been in a position to do so. But we gave our all to the band, and you will see for yourself how it ended. But it did not end as we would have hoped. You know, we thought that we were helping them to build something. We never knew that it was going to last 40 years, but we thought that we were part of the family, because certainly we put our lives on the line, you know, m more than once. And we thought that we had proven ourselves, and we thought that we had endeared ourselves to the band. As you will read, as certain entities entered the picture, the aura surrounding the band changed, and the people behind the scenes changed. And in doing so, they wanted to maintain a firm grip on the band, and they felt that that to do that, they needed to separate the band from those who they knew best, and fill those roles with people of their own choosing, so that they could call the shots in their own way. We never got a chance to work for the new people that came on board. And that was a bit, not a bit, it was very disappointing. But that's all I'll say about that. And you read it for yourself. And hopefully some of your listeners will feel good enough after listening to this interview to go out and purchase the book. The book is available on Amazon and on eBay. Although I must admit, I've gotten some feedback from some fans in Europe that it's not as difficult, or it's not as easy to purchase on eBay or Amazon as it is to purchase on our website, which is www.theoriginalkisscrew.com, and that's crew with a K, www.theoriginalkisscrew.com. And there's all sorts of fun stuff on there. There are interviews and other podcasts and the like, from other situations. None, of course, as stellar as yours. But there's a lot of good stuff on the site, and we do have a very thriving Facebook page, I'm proud to say, the Original Kiss Crew. We've added over 5,000 members in 6 months to that page, and we're very, very proud of that. And there's a lot of good stuff going on there. A lot of very knowledgeable people, not only from the fan side, but some of the people who produced some of the Kiss stuff that we know, some of the photographers that the fans may know, and they post some never before seen pictures, and it's always a very spirited discussion, So anyone that's interested, join us on our Facebook page, The Original Kiss Crew, and I'm sure you will be more than entertained.
Oh, I can second that too. And what I'll do is I'll put the links to everything you've just said, JR, into the podcast notes so people can just go straight to them as well.
Perfect. Perfect, man. I appreciate that.
So how did the book come about then? What was the genesis of Out on the Streets?
Well, the book came about for two reasons. First and foremost, I think it's the fans, the fans that knew about the contributions that the original crew made and appreciate that, and that just wanted to know a lot of the behind the scenes stuff, and the day-to-day chores and tasks that led up to surrounding a Kiss concert. They wanted to know, why we were no longer working with the band, something that I kind of touched on just now. And honestly, for us, it was just getting all of that stuff off of our shoulders and being able to shed some light and answer those questions, why we were no longer with the band and the events that led up to that. It was stifling us for decades. And we said, guess what? I mean, this is time. We're asked about this too often, and rather than continually answer that same question for individuals, let's write this book and let's get it out there. And we wrote the book, and thank you for your review. You probably would agree that we wrote the book from the standpoint of four guys who became brothers, based on the trials and tribulations that we went through helping to build a super group, and just like sitting around having a beer, chatting and reminiscing about some of the memories that we hold dear to us. That's the way that we wrote the book, and that's the way that that we wanted it to come across. You know, anyone that's looking for a constant diatribe and backstabbing, which a lot of the books that I've seen come out, written by some of the band members themselves, they do nothing but trash other members of the band. This is not that kind of book. This is, we literally, and it might sound corny, but we love those guys. We love them, man. We put our lives on the line for them, like I say, on more than one occasion. And no one would have put up with the obstacles that we willingly faced and overcame, in an effort to get the show out, and we're proud of that, and we're proud of being able to share that with the fans who appreciate that, especially the fans from the very early days, So thanks to the fans for pushing us, to get that done as well.
Oh yeah, and I love the way that the book's set out as well. You know, the whole structure of it is just it just makes for such great reading. It just immerses you into the story and into the life of what it was like back then.
Well, thank you for that. We can't please all of the people all of the time. We have heard one or two comments. Some, as a matter of fact, from one in particular from another podcast that shall remain nameless. But this particular group, they didn't appreciate many things in the book. But when we were able to sit and talk with them calmly and explain some of the excuse me, some of the things that were going on that they missed, I think that they're slowly becoming over to our side now and realizing, what they have. It's funny, but everyone has a different expectation of what they're going to get when they go to see a movie or read a book or whatever. And you don't always those expectations aren't always met, right, wrong, or indifferent. You know what I mean? But I think that somewhere in there, a logical person will sit back and say, well, you know what? This isn't really what I expected, but Jesus, man, and these guys, they did do everything that they set out to do. And the proof is in the pudding, and that proof is a legacy now that spans 4 decades. And like I say, we're very, very proud of that.
Oh yeah, it's it's so great that you're such an integral part of Kiss, the Kiss story in general. You know, people can't think of the history of Kiss and not think of you guys. That's for sure. You're a massive part of it. And what about another book from you then, JR? I mean, because you went on, you might have finished with Kiss, but then you went on to work with the likes of Aerosmith as well to begin with.
I worked with a lot of bands after. And life's been good. I can't complain. After leaving Kiss, I did work briefly with some of their label mates, a group called Angel. And Angel was a great band, infinitely more talented on their individual instruments than Kiss were. And I still am not sure why they didn't make it to the same level, but I saw in Angel the same potential that I saw in Kiss. That was not to be, but so be it. And you mentioned I did go on. There was a major management company at the time here in New York City called Lieber Krebs Management. Steve Lieber and David Krebs. And by the time I left Kiss, they were really the probably the excuse me biggest managers of hard rock acts at the time. They also produced a little show on Broadway called Beatlemania. I don't know how many people may be familiar with that. That's ancient history, but it was a musical version of the making of and the success around the Beatles. And they put together four lookalike guys who sounded amazingly like the Beatles, and they put a show on Broadway that lasted a few years, and then had a very strong touring life around the country, and that was very well received. But At the time, yes, I did work with Aerosmith, who was the Lee McCrae act. I worked with Ted Nugent. I worked with Golden Earring, who Lee McCrae was the U.S. manager for. They also were the U.S. representatives for AC/DC at the time. They did manage Scorpions, and with all of those acts, they were one of the first management companies to put on their first predominantly stadium events, consisting mostly of their own acts. If anyone cares to look up there was something called the California Jam, back in, I believe it's the first year was 78, if I'm not mistaken. And the majority of the bands that I mentioned just now, were the major draws, for that event and subsequent events of the type. So they pioneered a lot of what was going on in the business. They also managed George Clinton, Parliament Funkadelic, who I worked for, Bootsy's Rubber Band, some very funky guys that are about as far away from Kiss type music as you can get. But their stage show and their costumes were equally outlandish. You know what I mean? So
Oh, yeah.
they had their own thing going for them. And then after that, disco music became very popular, and I got paid quite well to work with artists like Evelyn Champagne King. They had a very big hit in the early days of disco, a song called Shame. Then there was Cheryl Lynn, who also was very big. Fortunate enough to work for Dr. John. Fortunate enough to work for Michael Jackson and the Jacksons. I worked with Cameo, Midnight Star, Atlantic Star. I managed Harry Belafonte's company for a while, and most people won't know who Harry Belafonte is, but Harry was a major star in the late 50s, and he introduced calypso music to the world. So Harry was like Harry was to calypso what Bob Marley was to reggae.
Oh yeah,
You know,
Harry was a big star. I remember
Harry
Harry
was
Belafonte, yeah.
yeah, he was a huge star. I managed his company for over a year and was very heavily involved with his touring operation and his merchandising. So there's a lot of stuff. I was fortunate enough to work for Ray Charles. And then I started promoting concerts myself. I promoted some shows in the Cayman Islands, which was a very, very popular tourist destination at the time. Promoted one of major act at the time was an English act, Maxi Priest. Third World, which was a big Jamaican reggae group at the time. And it was a wonderful thing, and one of the highlights, Harry was for sure the best tour that I ever worked on, because he was treated like royalty everywhere that we went. He was a UN diplomat. He had a red UN diplomat passport, and in Europe in particular, he was treated like royalty. We never saw the inside of an airport. When I tell you that customs officials came onto the plane to stamp our passports,
That's great.
I mean, it was just no better than that. You know what I mean? And the same kind of thing working with the Jacksons. Their tour at the time was the biggest tour. It was bigger than Kiss's tour. So I certainly couldn't feel bad about working for them, but I did allow myself to work do a show with Pope Benedict XVI in 2008. And although it wasn't financially rewarding as a lot of the other things that I did it simply because I wanted to have on my resume that I worked for the demon in Gene Simmons and I worked for the Pope. You know what I mean? And I worked with them both very closely. I was the stage manager and talent coordinator for the Pope when he came to the States in 2008, Pope Benedict. And they had something, and still do have something called the Papal Youth Rally.
Yeah.
And what that is an outdoor concert. And he did this one in the New York City area. And we built a stage, a huge stage on the grounds of of a large Catholic seminary in north of New York City, and we had 35,000 of Catholic youth
Wow.
come out. And we had 108 bishops from all around the country, and all at the time, I think there were 17 or 18 cardinals in the country from various dioceses, and we had all of them, and with that, we had nonstop music, 23 different bands from 11 a.m. until till 6 p.m. That evening. And our headliner, if you will, was Pope Benedict XVI, and he gave his homily, and everything went off without a hitch. And I was very, very proud to be a part of that. So, yeah, my career, I'm fortunate enough to say that it spanned a lot of decades, a lot of genres of music, and it's been a great ride. I couldn't have hoped for anything more. Well, I could have hoped for it, but I couldn't have demanded it, you know.
Well, you just whetted my appetite right there, JR, for another book with all these like post-kiss stories. Any plans for that, do you think?
I've, at some point in time, there may be. Honestly, we would like to maybe do another Kiss book because there are so many untold stories. This the book that you have and the book that's available, which, by the way, I don't think I even mentioned the title of it yet. The title of the book is Out on the Streets, subtitled The True Tales of Life on the Road with the Hottest Band in the Land, Kiss. And any Kiss fan that might be listening will recognize Out on the Streets as being the first words and the lyrics to a song that Peter Criss sang and ended the show, a song called Black Diamond. And you'll see how the title plays into our story as you approach the end of the book, and it's kind of ironical, but it's there for a purpose, you know what I mean? But yeah, we do have much, much more that we could say and share with the fans. The book as you have it now is 347 pages, and I'm sure we've got at least another 347 pages. So let's see what the future holds, and if the fans demand it, then certainly there's room for another one, and who knows, maybe a J.R. Smalling book as well.
Yeah. Well, I'm demanding both right now. I'm getting word in early.
There you go. There you go.
Well, thank you. Keep in touch. Whatever we can do over here in the UK to promote whatever you're doing, JR, we'll happily do it.
Sure. Sure.
Thank you so much for coming on today. I've just been sat here enthralled, as I'm sure all the listeners have as well. So it's been an absolute pleasure listening to the stories that you've told everybody today.
Great, great. Well, listen, thank you for the opportunity. I certainly do appreciate it. Thanks again to the fans for caring enough to give us the nudge, so to speak, to finally sit down these many years later and write this book. We really wrote it for you guys, and thanks so much, man. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
That's great. Well, I look forward to talking to you when the next book comes out.
Absolutely, and look forward to seeing you participating on our Facebook page as well.
Will do, most definitely. All right.
Okay, man.
Thanks,
Have a
JR.
good one.
You too, man.
Thank you.
All right. Bye
Bye-bye.
bye. Bye. And there we are at the end of another episode. And if you enjoyed it half as much as I did recording it, then you've definitely had a damn good time. I'd also like to take this opportunity to point out to any Kiss fans out there, if you're not already aware, of a great podcast. It's been going, I believe, 2015 is its 8th year, and that's Podkissed. It's one I've been subscribed to for about 3.5 to 4 years now. Thoroughly recommended. They've also had an episode with J.R. Smalling, so you can get some more stories from J.R. on that. If you subscribe to Podkissed, you also get the added benefit of getting the Kiss Room once a month as well with the great Matt Porter. So there's my recommendation for all you Kiss fans out there. Get subscribed to Podkissed. Also, make sure you visit the original Kiss Crew, the website. Buy the book. I'm about halfway through it now at time of editing, and Still thoroughly recommended to everybody. Follow JR, follow what he does. Hopefully he's going to have another book or two books out soon. Of course, I'll let you know as soon as any news comes through about that. You can follow me on Twitter at 60 Minutes With. You can also like on Facebook, facebook.com/60MinutesWith. iTunes reviews and ratings, greatly received. I'll be back again very soon. I've got some interview shows lined up, just waiting for dates to be sorted. And of course, we've got the regular entertainment shows with Chris and Ramrod. So, thank you for listening. Stay subscribed, and I look forward to chatting very, very soon.